Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, chilling out to some guitar playing by Govi, G-O-V-I. He's a German guitar player living on Hawaii, and the song is called Mumbai Express. Well, we're just going to go and get down to the lowdown on the Mumbai attacks of November 2008 with Elias Davidson. But in the meantime, take a moment and ask yourself, are you going to get this kind of global view of what's really happening in today's world anywhere else? National Public Radio? Democracy Now? Other alternative programs? Alex Jones? God forbid. No, you will not. So please do keep this going by going to truthjihad.com. You can make a one-time donation using the PayPal button, or you can subscribe. For only $3.95 a month, you'll get early access and free downloads. So if you want to get a sense of the realities of today's increasingly interconnected global reality, please support Truth Jihad Radio. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the all-out struggle for truth disguised as an internet radio show. It's been ongoing since 2006. Kevin Barrett, and I try to bring on the most important guests I can find with the most important things to say. And today we have an old favorite from way back, one of the key people in the 9/11 truth movement, somebody whose work on the complete lack of evidence for any actual hijackers or hijackings is extremely important with regard to 9/11. And he has a great new book out. It's Elias Davidson, whose book, The Betrayal of India, Revisiting the 2611 Evidence, is a 900-page blockbuster and appears to be heading for becoming one of the most important books ever published about false flags. So it's a real honor to bring on Elias Davidson. Thanks for coming back on Truth Jihad Radio, Elias. Good to have you.
Hello, Kevin. I'm happy to hear you. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, I really appreciate your work. You've been doing terrific work for many, many years on these taboo topics. And this latest book looks like a real blockbuster. This 2611 event in India, November 2008, mass shootings were one of the biggest, bloodiest apparent false flag operations ever. And you've got this book out now. Tell us a little bit about how you came to study this topic.
Well, I came to study the first step was, of course, the investigation of 9/11. And the first book appeared in 2013, Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, published in New York, 2013. And after having written that book, I was interested to take a look at the other terrorist attacks committed in Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and try to find out whether there was something in common between all these attacks. And I envisaged to publish an anthology of different terrorist attacks, including Bali, Mumbai, and so forth. So I began researching the London attacks and did a comprehensive investigation of that, which is available on the internet. And so I went on the attacks in Djerba in Tunisia, in Amman in Jordan, in Istanbul in 2004, if I remember correctly, and so forth. And then I came to the events in Mumbai, and I thought in the beginning that it will suffice to discuss them in one chapter of a book, but as much but when I began to delve into the Mumbai attacks, I found that it was a very complex operation which needed much more space. Eventually, it became an entire book. So, as you said before, it became a book of 900 pages, and it is the only comprehensive critical investigation of this event. I would say that it is basically a textbook about this event.
And so in terms of your overall interpretation of this series of high-profile terrorist attacks or apparent terror attacks all over the world, generally attributed to Muslims, 9/11 seems to be sort of the public relations for rollout of this series. Would you say that it appears that they look as if they may have been, at least to some extent, orchestrated by the same team? We've heard from Sibel Edmonds about Gladio B, that the Gladio operation that created most of the supposed left-wing terrorism during the Cold War, she argues, has morphed into a new Gladio B operation that is producing most of the high-profile Islamic terrorism. Would you tend to agree with that?
Yes, I do. I do. I believe that the war on terror, as it is called, was basically decided upon in the early 1990s, when it was clear that the Russian threat is not going anymore to be useful, and that there was a need for a new enemy to be established to keep the military strong and to give the United States reason for strengthening its hegemony worldwide, to keep together in NATO, and to establish a national security state. So basically, the decision, is my opinion, was already taken sometime early in the 1990s. I cannot say exactly when and by whom exactly, but this is, to my opinion, a very plausible conclusion. Now, if we look at the statements made by U.S. Leaders, they said repeatedly that the war on terror is going to last for generations. It means it was not an act initiated just to deter Al Qaeda or to act against those who allegedly committed 9/11, but it was staged as a long policy that would in fact be useful for many years or decades. And so there is a ground to believe that all these actions, all these terror attacks, are basically sourced by the same policymakers. How they are staged operationally is another question. Whether they are staged locally or in cooperation with U.S. forces or within NATO stands on another, is in another chapter. I don't know. But I think that the policy itself is centralized.
Okay, yeah, it looks that way to me, too. Let's look at this Mumbai attack from November 2008. Remind us of the kind of size and scope of the attack and what the official story was.
Okay. In the attack, it was said that 10 terrorists from Pakistan came by boat to Mumbai, to the shore, and distributed themselves into small groups of 2 and 4 people and began shooting at different locations in Mumbai, including particularly the main railway station, one hospital, a restaurant, a very known restaurant where a lot of foreigners came, the Taj Mahal Hotel, the Hotel Oberoi, and a Jewish religious center. And during these events, they killed 162 people and injured about 300 people. According to the official legend, 9 of the attackers were killed in clashes with the police and commandos, and just one was saved for a trial, which basically became a show trial.
And I alone am escaped to tell thee the official story.
Yeah, Herman one Waldo. Person was so-called, was not killed. He was brought to a trial and then convicted to hanging. And he was then hanged. So today we don't have anybody of those alleged perpetrators alive.
That's very convenient.
Very convenient. Now, what is important to know, to note already at first, is that very, very early on, the Prime Minister of India already blamed Pakistan for the attacks, even before the attack ended, before the attacks ended, and before any investigation was started. He already blamed Pakistan for the attacks.
Mm-hmm. This sort of reminds us how on 9/11 we already had the official story rolled out just minutes after the towers came down.
Exactly. Yeah. The same phenomena we have. Now, of course, this was political expediency, and one could just say, okay, he used that opportunity for political reasons. But as we see later, the court itself tried to frame the attacks as an act of war, which was, of course, absolutely ridiculous, because we are talking about 10 people shooting with AK-47 in different places in a town. It was, of course, not an attack by the Pakistani army, but basically a crime in Mumbai. But it was framed by the court and endorsed by the Supreme Court that it was case of a war on India.
And this is also reminiscent of 9/11, because framing it immediately as an act of war, as a new Pearl Harbor, totally derailed any criminal investigation. You know, you don't have a criminal investigation if a war starts.
Well, in India it was a little different, because there was a criminal investigation, in at least in the sense that one person was brought to trial, and there was a very long trial with many witnesses, and the judgment was published. So it is a very long judgment, which is about 1,000 pages. So in a sense, it was a little different than 9/11.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, we're still working on the first, well, I guess the Zacharias Moussaoui trial was sort of 9/11 related, but they're having military kangaroo courts now for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of the other 9/11 patsies. So I guess we will be having so-called criminal trials. So tell us, was the trial in India for this particular event as grotesque a miscarriage of justice as so far what's been going on here in the United States with these so-called these kangaroo court military trials?
Yes, of course. The trial in India was, first of all, it was an unfair trial by all international standards. And it was, in fact, decried by human rights organizations around the world as an unfair trial. For first, it was held in prison. And so it was not everybody was allowed even to attend the trial. Now, this is just one little thing. The lawyers of the accused were not allowed to meet him privately either. They could only meet him in the presence of police officers. So we have here already second item of unfair trial. The third thing was that the lawyers themselves, some lawyers who wanted to defend him, were intimidated and threatened with death if they would go and defend that kind of man, you know?
You know, and that's probably what would happen if any American military lawyers tried to mount a robust defense for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and these other 9/11 patsies. If they brought in architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth to prove that the buildings were blown up, they didn't just fall down from fires, I would think their lives might very well be in danger as well.
Exactly, exactly. So I'm just mentioning the first signs of an unfair trial, but this discussion here with you will not allow me to go through the trial, because in my book I spend I don't know how many dozens of pages just going through the trial and through the witnesses and all that. It is extremely much material. In any case, I can say today, as a conclusion of the trial, that in the very least, the main judge, was incompetent or acted disgracefully. But I think it went much further. That I think that the judge acted criminally in covering up the crime. So it is depending upon how you are interpreting the results, the conclusion of my work. In any case, this is it is extremely bad, because what happened is that the Supreme Court of India, which had a very good reputation worldwide before, had completely disappointed one by endorsing that judgment and that trial. And this is a big, big blow to the India justice system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now let's clarify this, and because I'm sure some of my listeners have heard about the fact that an apparent CIA agent who was working under Drug Enforcement Administration cover, a guy named David Coleman Headley, has been publicly named as the mastermind of the Mumbai attacks, and he was supposedly tried from his U.S. prison cell. But this is a second procedure, correct?
Yes, okay. David Headley is, from my point of view, I researched, as I said, quite intensively all these things, and I dedicate to his case a few pages. I think personally that David Headley is basically a red herring. It has nothing to do with the events in Mumbai. I don't believe at all that he was at all involved in any way in these attacks. So I think it has been used basically to deflect people from the real stuff.
Okay. Well, it's interesting, though, that they would choose an American intelligence agent to use as the kind of the mastermind patsy, the equivalent of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Yes, of course. I mean, I was asked by the publisher to look into this case, but I told him that basically there is no reason to go in depth into his case, because all the facts of the case show that it was completely irrelevant what he did or what he did not do. It was completely irrelevant in regard to the events. So it is like one would say, discussing Osama bin Laden in relation to 9/11 has no relevancy as long as one has not any evidence that Muslims committed the crime. If you don't have evidence that Muslims committed the crime, forget about Osama bin Laden. It is completely irrelevant to the case.
Okay, well, how did the trial result or the conclusions drawn at this trial relate to the attempt to pin the mastermind status on Headley?
In the trial in Mumbai, Headley was not at all. He was not an issue in the trial at all.
Really? Wow.
No.
Huh, interesting. So we kind of have sort of two official stories here. The conclusion that the trial was basically, did they claim that they got the case nailed, they got all 10 of the names of the actual shooters and so on and so forth?
Yes, exactly. That was basically what was done. I must also say that, okay, the trial itself went mostly around the person of Ajmal Kazab, who was the one in trial. But, however, in order to implicate him in a conspiracy, the court had to demonstrate that this conspiracy was connected to the nine others who allegedly were killed. So, basically, the trial had to deal with the entire operation. In fact, what happened is that most of the information which was presented in trial had to do with the alleged participation of Kazab, and the information on the participation of the nine others was extremely thin. There was very little which the court was told. There were very few witnesses. In fact, there was not a single witness in court which said that he saw any killing. So we had no person stating in court that he saw any killing in the Taj, in the Oberoi, in the Jewish Center, in the restaurant. None, not a single one.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did they establish the killings?
They did not establish the killings.
Interesting. So they basically just present a list of the names of victims and that's it?
Yes. More or less that.
Now, that's very interesting. And I know some of my listeners have studied some of these cases in which it's not clear that as many people died as we have been told. In some cases, they argue that there were nobody died. So, for instance, our mutual acquaintance, Jim Fetzer, has a book out called Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and there have been allegations about the possibility that some of these attacks are being staged in such a way that they, you know, they come in and shoot someplace up, and, you know, blanks are going off, people run away, and you can't really see what, you know, you can't really see what actually happened. And it may be easier in some cases to stage terror events without actual victims or with fewer victims, because the victims' family members are the ones who, you know, lock on and pursue justice, as we saw with the 9/11 family members. Is there a possibility that something like that happened here?
It is possible that something of that kind happened, at least partly. Let's say that it is possible that not all of the people listed as dead actually died, but I have no way to judge it. And there are good indications that at least some of the people really died. So it could be that the number is wrong, but I don't think that there was no dead people. I don't think that it was just simply a hoax. I find the suspicion that the attack at the railway station was somehow staged, but I cannot prove it. So I don't usually, in my book, I don't go into that theory, because I cannot really prove it. I can only give indications of facts. I can present facts which are extremely bizarre, and I let readers draw their own conclusions.
So give us a couple of examples of bizarre facts.
Well, bizarre facts are, for instance, when an old lady was said to have walked through the railway station while the two people were shooting around, and she just walked very slowly and nobody shot at her and so forth. This is very, very strange. Also, it is strange that many people apparently watched the shooting and did not run away. So it appears that they were not afraid of being shot. So these are a few of the testimonies which suggest that something was staged there.
So these are witnesses who reported seeing people not reacting the way one would expect in an actual shooting like this, but instead sort of acting as calmly.
Yes, well, I cannot from memory cite all these testimonies, but this was basically, there were some of the indications that eventually something was staged there. It is also possible that something was staged at the hospital, Kama Hospital, which were one of the part of the attacks allegedly took place. But to go into the details of this attack would be a little bit too much for me now by through memory. You know, I don't want to say anything which is not correct.
And so these witness reports of these strange facts, were these, did you get these from the actual trial transcripts?
Some of them are from the trial transcripts. Some of them are from interviews by named persons in English-speaking newspapers. So English-speaking newspapers are very like Hindu, like the Hindu or like India Today. They reported very heavily upon the events and had a lot of interviews with people they named. So when I have a named person saying so-so to these newspapers, I usually cite it. I could cite it.
Okay. Well, how about other sort of, you know, the kinds of pieces of evidence that don't fit the official story, like with 9/11, kind of the most obvious one is Building 7. Anybody who sits down and watches that building come down is told about when it came down, what the official explanation is, and then, you know, show them Larry Silverstein talking about the decision to pull it. And, you know, in 2 or 3 minutes, you can pretty well take any rational person and open them up to the very, you know, the obvious possibility that 9/11 isn't remotely close to what we were told it was. Are there things like that that you can describe that will open up the minds of our listeners, including the skeptical ones?
There is not, in my opinion, one particular case like World Trade Center number 7, which is so obvious, but there are in fact many points which are so bizarre that they should already lighten up a red light for anybody. I give you some examples. In the first news, you will have high officials saying that 25 terrorists landed in Mumbai, or 20 or 25. Now this number is taken from the air. They were not. At the end, they will say they were 10 people. First, they talked about 25 or 20, and some in, I think, New York Times were even mentioning 40. Then some of the news said there were 4 boats which were seen at the shore. At the end, they say it was just 1 boat. Now, in the first news, they said that up to nine terrorists were arrested and were being questioned. Very short after that, none of these 9 were arrested and questioned, but they were dead. So, you know, this kind of news are so bizarre. And I'm talking here not about what a journalist was saying, but what high officials were saying to the newspapers. And this information was published all over the world. I mean, it's not something which is published by some local newspaper. And also in the first news, you had a British newspaper saying that some of the perpetrators in Mumbai came from Bradford in Britain. They were British people. And this news disappeared completely. So you have already in the beginning absolutely information which was completely contrary to what was said later. So you have already in the beginning very many lies or disinformation which was peddled to the world media. Another thing which was peddled to world media was that the terrorists asked the people in the hotel whether they were American or British people, because they wanted to kill Americans and British. Now it happened that this was also a false information. There were in fact very, very few British and Americans who died in these attacks. So these are some of the very few details which show that the story is wrong.
Well, the one about the 9 terrorists having been arrested, and then suddenly the next day they're all dead. I mean, that's a kind of a smoking gun, isn't it? Because if that's the government stating that they've got 9 people under arrest, and then the subsequent statements say they're all dead, one would think that journalists would be challenging those government officials on this. Did any kind of journalistic follow-up on this happen?
No, nobody in India followed up on that question. They just changed the story. It's sad. There is another case of this kind of change of story. In one case, in the first night, it was reported in the media in Mumbai, in India, that both terrorists which were involved in a shootout with the police at Girgaon Chaupati, one of those being the Ajmal Kazab, and the other one his companion, they were both shot dead at a shootout. Now, a few hours later, the story changed in the media, and it was told that one of them survived. This Kazab survived. He was not at all shot. At the end of the day, it was not even known whether he was shot at all. So we had a change of story within a few hours, and it was done in a very, very smooth way, so nobody basically noticed it.
Interesting. Do you think that the way this was done, with all of these multiple location shootings over quite a period of time, it was designed to create the kind of confusion where they could get away with all of this adjusting of their initial reports?
No, I don't think so. I think there were in fact 2 operations taking place simultaneously in Mumbai. One was what I would call the domestic operation, which would include the attacks at the railway station, at the hotel, in Girgaon Chaukpati, and the killing of 3 police officers. So this was the domestic operation, which in my opinion was carried out mainly by Indian commandos. And we had the international operation, that is so-called, which was directed at locations where a lot of foreigners were located, such as the restaurant, the hotels, and the Jewish center. And that operation was, in my opinion, carried out in cooperation with U.S. Or British commandos, or at least in cooperation with the U.S. and the U.K. So I think these 2 operations had different goals, but were scheduled to take place simultaneously in order to implicate Pakistan.
Interesting. So we understand why elements of the Indian government would want to implicate Pakistan. There's been this tension between India and Pakistan for quite some time, and there are hardline elements that want to exacerbate that in India. But why the U.S., when the U.S. and Britain would get involved with this, what would be their angle?
Okay. Now I have to enter the interest of the United States regarding India. In order to discuss that, one must delve into U.S.-Indian relations and the strategic importance of India for the United States. Now, this is, of course, a very big chapter by itself, to which I also dedicate a long chapter in my book. First of all, let us begin by setting out the interest shown by the US to the attacks in Mumbai on 29th of 11 2008. There was an extremely high interest shown already from the first hours. There was in fact a high level committee set up under the White House to manage the crisis in Mumbai. This is unknown in the United States, but this is a fact which I document in my book. The FBI was extremely interested in the attacks and had already its own people going to Mumbai within hours to participate in so-called investigations. The New York Police Department had a very, very strong interest in the Mumbai attacks also. And the Homeland Security Office had a very strong interest in the Mumbai attacks. So this interest began hours, I'm talking not days or weeks, but hours after the beginning of the attack. That means during the attacks themselves, the U.S. Leadership was involved in monitoring and managing the crisis.
Very interesting.
And yeah, these are facts.
But yeah, and that has not been widely reported, including here in the truth movement in the U.S., where there's an interest in false flags in general and the U.S. relationship to them in particular. I don't think that has been noticed much. So you're really doing us a service by calling attention to this. Well, how would this fit into the strategic picture that you mentioned, the U.S. imperial interest in India?
There are at least three dimensions to the strategic interests. One is a very large geostrategic interest to prevent India from going into the Shanghai organization, to go along with China and Russia into a kind of a regional organization, and to nudge India into the imperial, the US-led imperial system. So this was one very important thing which was done with Indian supporters or allies to the US to try to nudge India into a stronger cooperation with the US under the heading of the war on terror. The second reason was to find reasons to involve cooperation with India in monitoring the Indian Ocean, which was a strategic area for the United States regarding Iran and the Gulf states. The third dimension of the strategic cooperation was that India is a very, very big market for weapons and security technology and for U.S. corporations, as much as a very, very cheap pool of very well-educated labor in, for instance, in computer industry, which could be used by the U.S. corporations. And the fourth dimension of the strategic interest in India was to use India as a laboratory for the construction of a national security state.
Okay. And keeping India and Pakistan in a state of extreme tension at each other's throats, I guess, could possibly be in this U.S. imperial interest as well, given that the interest in trying to torpedo this Shanghai cooperation zone could involve, for instance, trying to make sure that these nations don't all get into it, because Pakistan has been cooperating with China, and if India and Pakistan are not fighting with each other, they may be more amenable to allowing this kind of zone to be established.
I agree with you. I agree.
Very interesting stuff. Okay, so has there been any kind of truth movement or skepticism about this within India? I know a couple of people, Feroz Mithibarwala, who I actually saw in Tehran last week at the Palestine conference, is well known as a leading truth movement figure in India. And he has, of course, expressed skepticism about the official version of Mumbai. But aside from that, I'm not really aware of a domestic Indian reaction seeking the truth about this?
Well, Feroz is, of course, an old friend, and he, in fact, helped me to get in touch with the publisher. So I'm very happy that you met him also. In India, there were basically two or three, I would say three people or four people, let's put it this way, who expressed doubts about the official story, but particularly about the killing of the three police officers, which was part of the so-called domestic operation. Now, one of the police officers, called Karkare, he was on the way of revealing false flag operations by Hindu nationalist groups, and he had to be eliminated. So the reason for his elimination is said to eliminate somebody who would reveal such terrorist attacks. Now, in eliminating him, they eliminated also two other police officers. And the wife of one of the other police officers, called Vinita Kamte, she is a lawyer by profession, and she wrote a critical book about the attacks, but limited to the attacks on the police officers. Another person who wrote a very good, in fact, two books about the attacks, is a former policeman, Mushrif, who wrote about the attacks, but also limited himself to the attacks on the domestic operation. And there was somebody with whom I don't have, by the way, I had contact with both of these authors, very good contact, and they were, in fact, encouraging me to do my research. Now, a third person tried to get information revealed by the Supreme Court, and he made some efforts. I don't remember his name. So there were three or four people who did some questioning officially, publicly. But there was nobody in India, to my knowledge, who put the entire operation in question.
Interesting. Well, in your book, in your conclusion, you're calling for a genuinely independent investigation of this whole affair. Is there any chance that that could happen, and what would be the path to it?
I don't think that there would be an independent investigation unless there is a very large political constituency demanding it. And under the circumstances in India, I don't see that happening tomorrow. Because even the Communist Party in India basically endorsed the official story.
Wow. Well, how about like Arundhati Roy is famous for questioning certain aspects of the war on terror and some of the basic policies of the Indian government. Are there any people like her, celebrities in India, who could get behind this and perhaps give it some traction?
Well, I have no contact to her, and I don't know whether she would be willing to do that. She has been rather cautious in dealing with false flag operations.
That's true, yeah. She cut tiptoes right up to the edge and then backs off.
So I don't expect anything of...
I can't get her on the show. I've invited her a few times. I really admire her work, and I suspect that she knows more than she has clearly stated about this false flag epidemic. But maybe it's just one of those red lines that, if you're that well known, you probably have good reasons to be afraid of crossing it.
Yeah, this is possible. I cannot say anything about her person as such. I also admire her her work, but it is my position is a little bit similar to that I have towards Noam Chomsky. I admire his work, but I cannot understand the blind spot he has towards 9/11 and false flag operations.
Well, he's worse than Arundhati Roy. I mean, Chomsky is actually not only avoiding it, he's actually attacking the truth movement. And his work really does make you wonder whether he's part of the cover-up team. You know, he's been so negative and destructive in every way. His original, his first analysis in his book 9/11, as I explained at last year's Left Forum in New York City, is obviously, you know, from the get-go, it's steering everybody in the wrong direction. And yet, rather than adjusting course over the years, he's become more and more entrenched in attacking the truth movement, ridiculing it, and making utterly nonsensical statements about 9/11, just absurd, blatant, you know, irrationalities. So I don't know whether, you know, senility or, you know, how can you possibly explain Chomsky?
I have not tried to explain it except for myself, except that this man has been, you see, when you are committed to a certain belief, it is very difficult to get out of that belief, even by arguments. We know it from psychology. So I personally just attribute that to his own psychology, which we all have. If we believe, for instance, that it is extremely bad for the health to eat eggs, it can be very difficult to shed that belief and be saying, no, eggs is very good for health, you know, or milk or whatever. Many people have beliefs in all kinds of things, and it is very difficult to get them out of their beliefs, even with arguments. So I don't attribute his position to anything else than a very common feature of human psychology.
Well, I was told by a very reliable source that one of Chomsky's big financial backers discussed 9/11 with him and reported that early on, I think back, you know, not that long after it happened, maybe in, you know, 2002 or something, he admitted that he knew it was an inside job. So, I mean, maybe there's a problem in the chain of transmission of that story. I don't know. But given his, you know, that it's one thing to defend a false belief in a, you know, stubborn and irrational way, but, you know, the extreme kinds of irrationalities in what Chomsky says, such as, oh, even if you prove it was controlled demolition, that will just show that bin Laden did it, that sort of thing. I mean, this is so unworthy of somebody who's a leading public intellectual that you have to think that there's something really strange going on in his mind.
Well, exactly. But what you said now tends rather to support my idea that he's just simply stubborn and holding to a belief. Because if he were really an agent trying to cover up something, he would be much more slick and much more slick and not using this kind of stupid arguments. So anyhow, I don't think this is anyhow very relevant to our investigations.
Well, it is in the sense that we're talking about the Indian sort of alternative intelligentsia like Arundhati Roy and how they've dealt with this sort of thing.
Well, basically, we have that problem all over the world. We have that in Germany, where I'm living. We have the entire peace movement unwilling to look into 9/11. And I don't buy the idea that all of these people are sub-agents or are manipulated by the intelligence. I believe that we have really that problem. It's a psychological problem that if you commit yourself to a certain belief, it is extremely difficult for any person to leave that belief. We have that problem with all the people who believed in the Soviet Union and had to face stories about Gulag and all that. Many of these people did not believe it. They didn't want to believe that Gulags had ever existed. So we have very many cases of that in history, in recent history, in old history, of people who just don't want to admit facts. And this is, I'm sorry, this is part of human nature. And I think that I believe that most of these problems arise from that. And we can basically trace that problem to the enormous propaganda which were carried out on 9/11 worldwide. Extremely a propaganda operation of unknown dimensions. So I think this explains very much what we have today.
Well, there are plenty of examples of people clinging to beliefs that are completely and blatantly wrong. You know, the Americans who don't understand that their country has killed tens of millions, 55 million by one count, endorsed by Andrei Volchek and Noam Chomsky in their book on Western terrorism since World War II, and yet the average American thinks that their foreign policy is basically, if anything, too generous and peaceful and so on. That's what Trump is playing on. And another example, of course, is the supporters of Israel, many good, kind, liberal people who imagine that Israel is the light of democracy and so on and so forth. And speaking of Israel, Elias, you're well known for arguing that it's basically the sort of Gladio U.S. imperial deep state that was behind 9/11, and to the extent that Israel was involved, it would have been more as a junior partner and a potential scapegoat after the fact. And similar kinds of discussions have come up about terrorism elsewhere, including in India, where there is apparently a close cooperation between extremist Hindu elements of Indian intelligence and the Israeli Mossad. Both sides are basically raging Islamophobic kinds of ultra-nationalistic extremist types of people. So what's your take on any kind of Israeli relation to this event and to other terror events in India?
Well, the relation between Israel and India is not very well known in the United States. India is the biggest weapons customer of Israel. This must be just stated straight away. For Israel, India is a very important partner in security and military as a customer. Many Indian commanders are also trained in Israel, so there is a very intensive relationship. In India, this relationship is downplayed in order not to get the Muslim population angry. So they don't highlight these relationships, but in Israel they do that, and they have no problem of emphasizing this relationship. Now, having said that, India, the biggest deliverer of military equipment for India is not Israel but Russia. So this must also be added in order a little bit to put it into perspective. For Israel, India is a very important trade partner, and also politically very important partly in order to blame Muslims and to incite against Muslims. But from the Indian point of view, Israel is basically only one of many partners with whom India wants to have dealings, but doesn't want to deal completely. What doesn't want to really to get too much connected. So it is an asymmetrical relationship. Now, concerning false flag operations, there is of course a reason to suspect that Israel was involved in the operations in Mumbai, particularly because this Jewish center was attacked, and because the attackers were blamed in the Western press as being led by anti-Semitic feelings or by support of Palestinian terrorism. Now, of course, these stories are baseless because the attackers were not identified and had nothing, of course, with Palestinian terrorists. They were not sympathizers of Palestine. However, if one looks at the details, it is difficult to find any evidence that the Mossad was basically involved in the operation. Particularly, the Mossad would have very little interest in attacking the hotels or the restaurant. Its only interest was the attack on the Jewish center. So another thing is that the relationship between the Chabad Center and its U.S. backers was very, very open, and the interest of Israel in its nationals who were killed there was completely open. There was no secret about it. So in a way, I have the doubts that Israel would involve itself in such an operation, having all that, all these facts in mind. However, in my book, I said that the Israeli government should, if it wants to clean its role in the operation, should also support an investigation. But I don't think that Israel will do it. It doesn't do it in other things either. So I am a little bit cautious in saying that Israel was involved. I find it much more evidence of U.S. and possibly British involvement is much more likely, in my opinion.
Well, the narrative that we hear from some folks, including some of my colleagues in Pakistan, is that the Israeli Mossad and Israeli deep state works with the Indian deep state and, to some extent, the Western deep state, U.S., British, etc., and their shared objective has been to essentially undermine Pakistan, to destabilize Pakistan, to try to break up Pakistan, such as by fostering this so-called, you know, this terrorism, this Takfiri-type terrorism in places like Baluchistan. And all of this is designed to try to mess with Pakistan's getting closer to China. That's the U.S.-British interest. But more importantly, perhaps, the extremist Hindu element in India and the Israeli element have a shared interest in knocking Pakistan down to the point that they'll be able to justify a special forces type attack on Pakistan to take out its nuclear weapons. That the end game of this is to get rid of the Pakistani nuclear weapons, and the two forces that want to do that are the Israelis and the Hindu extremists in India, and that this kind of terrorism is basically designed to stoke up this tension with Pakistan as part of an effort to destabilize Pakistan, make it a failed state, and ultimately launch a raid to take out its nuclear capability, and that Israel is a spearhead for this.
Well, I could at least agree with some of your explanations. I think they make sense, except that I don't consider that Israel is here in the leading seat, because Israel is not a world empire. Israel is basically a satellite of the United States and the West, has been from the beginning also. It was established by the United Kingdom as a Western outpost in 1917 and has remained that all the time. So basically Israel is, you can look at the Israel basically as part of the Western imperial system, not as a leader of it, but as a part of it. And so far I agree with you.
Okay, well, we're going to probably have to leave it there because we're just about at the end of the hour. So, Elias Davidson, I appreciate your excellent work on 9/11, which I will be linking at the radio blog, and also this new book, The Betrayal of India, Revisiting the 2611 Evidence, brand new book, and it belongs on the bookshelf of anybody interested in false flag terror and the deep state. Just as those topics are going viral, the term false flag is starting to come out and become used in the mainstream media without any explanation because everybody knows what they are. The term deep state is now on everybody's lips. Front page news in the New York Times today, deep state, Trump, deep state, deep state. So I think this awareness is rising, and work like yours, Elias, is really contributing to it. So thank you, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.